First job out of school was with a newspaper, The Doings, and then I also did a lot of freelance work for the Daily Herald.
He reached in next to the bed. One of the agents thought he was going for a gun. Instead, he pulled out a badge and said, I'm one of you.
Oh, no.
I'm a Dixmoor Park District cop.
The lesson that I have to say you learn through being a journalist. I mean, you hear that and you're like, who would have the gall possibly do that? Who would have the nerve?
And they did
to even think about it,
and
let alone
it.
Doing it. It's
right?
Not a movie. It is continually shocking. And I think that is the lesson to, again, any sort of aspiring journalist is when your impulse is to say, no way, no how, nobody would do that.
Right. Keep digging.
Keep digging.
I saw a little bead of sweat break out on Father Andrew's brow, and I was hooked.
This is fun.
Now, from WGN Radio News, a look back at the day that was, and a deeper look into issues and stories with Andrea Dahlers and the reporters on 720 WGN.
It is 720 WGN. Happy Monday to everybody out there. Our panel of journalists are in studio and ready to go. Joe Maher and Carrie Lester are here. Amy Rutledge was to have joined us, but she has a couple of sick children at home, so she's taking a little bit of a rain check, taking care of her family. She'll be with us in 2 weeks. We have baseball next week, so we'll be preempted. We're going to be encountering a lot of this lately now that the White Sox are back in action and baseball's back, so it's a double-edged sword. It's a plus and a minus. We're happy that there's baseball, but we do get preempted every now and again, and this is a week that we are not preempted. As I mentioned, Carrie and Joe are here. Carrie Lester, you know her for the Center for Illinois Politics, and Joe Maher from the Chicago Tribune. You guys, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's going to be a blast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit about yourself and your background. Carrie, let's start with you. I know you're with the Center for Illinois Politics, but we knew you from the Daily Herald, from the Associated Press. Tell us a little bit about where you've been.
Right, okay. Well, I got my start. My first journalism job was as a staff reporter for the Archdiocese of Chicago's newspaper. So I was telling Joe in the green room that I found that the Cardinal, who is the publisher, is not really just a figurehead. He went through that thing with a red pen. It was Cardinal George at the time. So I was there for a few months, and I was freelancing at the Herald, and that then parlayed into a part-time job in the features department and then a full-time job. And I went from covering a school district out in Elgin, which I still consider my favorite beat of all time, to covering politics. And then I left the Herald to write for the AP. I was a bureau chief down in Springfield in the state capital during the great big budget impasse, which felt like Groundhog Day all over again.
No, I'm kidding.
It was a multi-year thing, and
right.
I was there for those years.
Yeah.
And then I came back to the Herald to write a column, took a buyout in December of 2017, and recently had a baby, was doing some freelance work, and just signed on to be the editor at the Center for Illinois Politics, which is a nonprofit, nonpartisan data site that analyzes political trends.
And election night analyst, if I can say. You
yes,
were part of our panel
yes,
this year for this historic election.
That was a historic night.
We had a good time at the Billy Goat. Joe, you're going to have to come to our next election with us.
we have
a good time. We had a lot of cheeseburgers, talked a lot of politics, but yeah. Joe, you're with the Chicago Tribune. Welcome. Tell us where you've been in the past.
Yeah.
Well, I've known you only through the Tribune.
That's right. Well, I've had 25 years in this business as a newspaper reporter, and I started out at a really small paper. It's unusual nowadays for kids getting in the industry, but I started off at a paper that had, I think it was a 16,000 circulation, and my annual pay was less than that. So it was.
First job.
We should talk about that annual pay.
We should. First salary. First media salary.
Okay. It was 27,000 on paper, but then there were pay cuts.
Rich.
I came in, and it was 25,500.
Whoa. Okay, Joe.
Yeah, and I think mine was either 14 or 16. It was lower than the circulation, I remember. Mine was
16 as well.
Yeah, so and this was, I mean, it was enough to buy beer and wings, I remember,
there you go.
One night a week, but beyond that.
Yeah. Dollar slices, dollar beers, that's about what we could afford. You were part of a Pulitzer Prize winning team when you were in Ohio.
I was, yeah. That was my third paper, and that was my hometown paper, the Toledo Blade. Crazy story. I'll tell you.
Please.
60 seconds of your life, you'll never get back.
I want to know. Carrie and I are intrigued.
So basically, there was an Army commander, a former retired commander of the CID of the Army. It's basically the FBI of the Army, the police force. This guy had retired in the 70s, and he kept this box of documents from his era. He kept it in his basement in Washington, D.C. So there was a Toledo Blade reporter that lived near him because we had a bureau over there at the time in D.C. And this guy, unfortunately, was dying of cancer. And he said, you know, I've got this box of stuff. I was going to write a book, but I can't do anything with it. Why don't you guys take a look at it, see what you want, and then just make sure it gets to the University of Michigan sometime.
Okay.
So it was sent to the Toledo office, and nobody really knew what to do with it. The guy who sat in front of me, one of my mentors, a guy named Mike Sala, was tasked with looking through this box and saying, okay, is there anything there we can write? Maybe an enterprise story? Maybe there was some crime of the day that we can get more details on. So he's going through this box, right? All these big case files, and he comes across this tiny case file in this unit called Tiger Force. And it was maybe 10 pages or so. But the war crimes described were horrendous. So this was in the earlier days of the internet, about 15 years ago. And he's looking through, and he's like, nobody's ever written about this. And this was a unit that was, allegedly doing some really, really, sad things.
Yeah.
He started looking into it, and another guy came on the team. Eventually, I came on the team, and we were able to document the longest string of war crimes by a battle unit in Vietnam. And also, it was the longest war crimes investigation of the Vietnam era. It went 4.5 years straight up to the White House.
Oh, my
God. Then they buried it. So there were 18 people recommended for charges up to murder. This was a unit that sadly had, denigrated to, at times, just lining up people and mowing them down.
Holy cow. And it would have never been found had the
I'm going home and reading this tonight.
Yeah.
Right? I know.
And it was just a sad story because on so many levels. So of what happened in Vietnam and then of what happened to these soldiers. There were a lot of these soldiers who went back home. There was one guy who drank himself to death just because he couldn't handle it. And so it was just a really sad chapter that, it's when those kinds of stories are mixed blessings, right? Because, as a reporter, you want to dig this stuff up and you feel a sense of pride from digging it up. But also, it's just tragic what happened. I mean, there are days that I root for the fact that there's nothing for me to write about, and I'm you hope everything's working out because don't want to be writing about bad stuff. But that was a wild story.
That sounds right out of The Post. Did you see that movie with Catherine Graham and the Watergate box comes in and some night cops reporter is looking through it and going, is this anything? Is this anything? Mm-hmm. And then they stumble upon these big documents.
Isn't it crazy how certain stories that evolve start from just basically nothing that probably never would have even been written about, especially pre-internet, how you find something like that.
Exactly.
I'm sure you've had instances like that too, Carrie, especially with the Herald.
Well, I was thinking as I was coming here about some of my favorite stories, and I'm sure you do, Joe. I have a whole roster, but when I was a cub reporter at the Herald, I was assigned to cover the school district out in Elgin, and as I'm sure you guys remember in your reporting days, I don't know if they do it anymore, but you have the police scanner on in the background,
right? Sure.
And at first, it's very distracting. You can't work, you can't figure out how to type with that noise blaring, but then you learn to keep half of an ear to it, and you learn to do your work at the same time. And I was, maybe 2 months into the job when I heard something on the scanner that a student had attacked a teacher at Elgin High School. And I was so discombobulated by this because this was my beat that I got on the wrong direction in the highway, not in the wrong lane, but I went east when I was supposed to be going west.
Yeah.
And showed up at the hospital and found that a student had trouble at home and brought a knife to class. And after final exams, second semester, at the end of the first semester, he stabbed this favorite teacher of hers.
Oh my God.
And stabbed her in the eye. She lost the eye. Took all this time off to teach. He was sent to juvie, and there was just a lot of mystery as to why this happened. This was a well-performing student. This was one of his favorite teachers. It just didn't make any sense, and so it stuck kind of in my craw. And I really worked to establish a relationship of trust, trust building with this teacher, and made her feel like she could safely tell her story to me. And then I tried to get at the other components of the stories over a 4 or 5 year period. I talked to the school district about how they handled the safety element of it, how it changed, how they addressed, do they fleece students at the door for weapons? Do they put metal detectors at the gate? I talked to the teacher that ultimately came to her rescue next door and saved her life. And then for years, I wrote the kid letters in prison trying to get on his visitors list. And so eventually I did, and I drove all the way down to Lawrence, Illinois, Southern Illinois, and interviewed him across the glass.
How many years later was this?
It was 3.5, 4 years later. And
holy cow.
That was one of the more puzzling and I think heart-wrenching parts of it all. You know, you have this teacher who's attacked. She comes back to the classroom. She teaches. It's a story of bravery, you know, conquering evil, all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you go down to talk to this kid and you hope there's an answer, right? He was having some trouble at home. His parents were getting divorced. His home was in foreclosure. But you wanted to hear why he did it. You know, I snapped. I was having a tough time. And he was really puzzled. He didn't know. And he wasn't getting adequate mental health services at the prison. So you felt like he wasn't really getting a lot better. And, right. and there wasn't mm-hmm. healing or closure. And so I remember telling the teacher that I was going down to do that interview. And so I had to talk to her afterwards. And she said, well, why did he do it? And I said, you know, to have to
did
tell her.
Did he tell you why?
He didn't know. He didn't know. You know, yeah. I don't know. And what he said to me was, and do you think I can visit her when I get out? And, you know,
no
that just breaks
kidding.
Your heart, right?
Like, was it legit, though, Gary? Like, he really felt kind of showed a little bit of remorse for what he had done?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm no psychologist. Yeah. I'm not analyzing what's going on in his brain. But, sure. but yeah, he seemed genuinely puzzled in that he had genuine affection for this woman that he savagely attacked. So, anyway, you know, you do all that reporting on this story. And the silver lining of it all was I looked at how schools and police departments communicated with one another because the boy was having some trouble outside of school.
Right.
And I wanted to know why the school didn't know about it, even if they couldn't publicly talk about it. And that ultimately led to a change in Illinois law that allows schools and police departments to kind of covertly communicate with one another to give each other a heads up about troubled students.
What an amazing feeling of gratification that a story that was as organic as the one that Joe mentioned too, and just kind of grew mm-hmm. and grew and grew, changed a law.
I think it felt good, but it also didn't feel like enough. You couldn't give the teacher her eye back. You couldn't do
true,
you know,
true.
Any,
but I mean, if
like
anything,
that.
If there was any sort of you know good that could come from it, at least now there's a law where there's communication between police and schools.
Yeah, silver lining for sure.
Absolutely. Yes. We're talking to Carrie Lester and Joe Maher on Andrea and the Reporters. We're going to hear more stories from Carrie and Joe, and we will get to some of the news of the day. Maybe. It's more interesting mm-hmm. hearing about your background and stories that you've covered. But stay with us. We have much, much more to come. 720 WGN.
It's Andrea Darlis and the Reporters on 720 WGN.
Thanks for being with us tonight. Joe Maher from the Chicago Tribune, Carrie Lester, Center for Illinois Politics, our guest on Andrea and the Reporters tonight. So we're telling some war stories, just literally different stories that we've covered, and learning more about both of you and again, different stories that you've covered and followed throughout your career. And I want to know why you each decided to enter this crazy, ever-changing, on a daily basis, business of ours. Joe, why don't we start with you? Where did you grow up, and how'd you decide to enter the field?
So I grew up in a small town outside Toledo, Ohio. And I wasn't sure what I wanted to do with my life, but I thought I didn't want to be an engineer and sit behind a desk. You know, I probably should have been an engineer and sit behind a desk, but I didn't want to be an engineer.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was like, back, like,
pension, stability. Yeah. Right.
But I went to college at Kent State and was going to be a radio disc jockey, was what it was going to be of all things. And then I'm a little embarrassed to say this. So a buddy of mine who was going to a different state university a couple hours away invited me down and said, you know, you've got to come down to IRU. They've got this great Halloween party. So I went down there, and I was like, wow, what a beautiful campus, and what a nice atmosphere.
What a great party.
So it's like I had to pick a major. So I'm like, I was going down the list, and I thought, I guess journalism. I'll transfer here and go to journalism.
Yeah.
And then I walked in the college campus newsroom, and I had to come up with a story, and I had overheard something about some crazy wild spring break arrest of people. So I called the police department in Florida, and here I was, this like 18, 19 year old kid, and they were like answering the phone call, and they were like, sure, we'll send you the report, sir. And I was like drunk with power. I was oh my God, these guys are actually going to, back in those days that the technology was faxing, right? So they were like, oh my God, they're going to fax me the report. This is great. So it felt really cool to be able to dig up this information and write the story. And it was like intoxicating. It's like, man, this is the gig for me. I'm going to get paid to just talk to people.
Oh, that's awesome. Right. And it went from there.
Yeah. And I used to hate writing, but now I like the
writing.
Well,
now you like it. Yeah. Now it's deadline. So
yeah.
And
you
there's
love
a
it,
question
it.
If you're a reporter or a writer, right?
I know. I started out as a reporter and I hated the writing, but now I really like the writing. So
you've made the transition.
Yeah.
Writer/reporter. Carrie, how about you? You're a local
I think
girl.
I started as a writer and then became more of a reporter, and I think in it discovered how much I like people and getting to know people and see how they tick and everything. So to me, every beat that you have, like my favorite part about it is kind of getting to figure out those personalities.
Yeah, I always think that you have out of radio, TV, print, I'm going to say print, which is now I know multimedia and writing online, but I always thought that the print journalists had the the biggest challenge? You know, because you're really describing for everybody. You know, TV, it's easy. Okay, you're looking at the picture, and I'm basically describing what I'm seeing to you. Radio is a little more challenging, but I think print reporters, I think, just really have it. It's a gift to be a print reporter.
I had this editor and mentor who would always say, "Show, don't tell," with your writing, and so
exactly,
that's the challenge.
What's one of the best stories that you've ever covered, or the most intriguing one that sticks with you?
There are so many, but I was thinking a few moments ago when we were listening to the news about when I was at the Associated Press when the Denny Hastert scandal broke.
Oh,
I was down at the State House in Springfield, but I had come from the Daily Herald, so I had these contacts in the suburbs, and so they, you know, the AP is a well-oiled machine, and said, pack a bag, go. And so got a rental car. I headed up to Yorkville, Illinois, and just drove around that town all day, every day. And they paired me with, you know, I was just a State House reporter, but they paired me with a national investigative reporter. And, you know, while he was digging into documents, I was in the library and I was looking at high school wrestlers and cheerleaders and figuring out where they lived now. Were they still in town? Were they not? And you were trying to crack that nut of who these victims were and who would talk. Mm-hmm. And so what was fascinating, I remember this one instance where I discovered that there was a little like dive bar, shot in a beer dive bar across the street from the Yorkville refrigerator factory. And so I went in there one day for lunch and ordered grilled cheese, and I'm talking to these guys in these blue uniforms coming across on their lunch break. And you're hearing a lot of things, but with the AP and anonymous sources, there's a very high bar with which they're going to let you report. And so it was interesting. It was like I remember digging and finding a lot of the answers that I think later NBC broke or something when that first victim's name came up. But the AP knew that, and they weren't ready to pull the trigger because they had a different standard. And so that sticks with me, just the shoe leather, the true shoe leather reporting involved in that story. And then later, it was more than a year later when Hastert was sentenced at the Dirksen Federal Building. I was sitting there, and Tom Durkin, who is the brother of House Republican leader Jim Durkin in Springfield, he just laced into Hastert to a degree I have never seen in a courtroom anyplace else. Like, he called him a serial child molester and a predator, and just over and over and over again hammered into him. And I thought it was interesting because of the Durkin's history with Republican politics, and then Hastert being this former House Speaker, and it was really a surreal thing. So that's one story that sticks with me.
Well, plus two, it's a story that you're following that had happened years earlier when he was a wrestling coach, or he was a coach at the school too. So you're having to go back decades and generations to find these victims, or just to find people to talk about it.
And how those stories still stick with people, right? You had one of the victims who had died of AIDS decades ago, but there was a twist in that that not only Durkin's brother was involved in the case, but Tom Cross's brother was one of the victims. And so it was, we had known for a long time that he was one of the victims, but he was not ready to go on the record. And so you protected that, you know, you want to honor that, you know, and he, so mm-hmm. I remember preparing my story for if and when he would talk, and just being ready to hit the button when that news came out. But to see grown men break down in court, you know, and to face this person who has abused them is just heartbreaking. And I think of that now all the time when I read about the Catholic Church's abuse scandal.
Right. So, very emotional story. Yeah. You covered it really well, too.
Oh, thank you.
Joe, how about you? One of the stories that really
sticks with me is it's frustrating because sometimes you'll write stories and you don't get the change that, you know, you think is going to come. You know, as a reporter, you never want to, I don't want to cross the line as an advocate, right? But there's also, you have common sense too, right? So you think, boy, you're going to report this. If I were in charge, I'd fix something. So the story that sticks with me is one I did down in St. Louis when I was with the Post-Dispatch in 2008. And this was a story, and this may surprise a lot of people, but it has to do with fugitives, right?
Okay.
And what I uncovered basically is that, you know, a lot of times for many fugitives, even some serious fugitives, you can run and you need not hide. What happens in this country, there are some places that I could probably do an armed robbery, leave my thumbprint, leave my driver's license, do a selfie, say, hey, it was Joe Maher, here, it was here,
yeah,
and I just move. You know, and if I move far enough away, what happens is the police either won't put my warrant in the national computer, you know, and or they might put it in, but they're not going to come pick me up if I'm far enough. So we have a system in this country, and what I, how I did it, this will show my nerd side, okay? So I apologize.
We're all there.
Yeah. No, we're all there.
You're in good company.
Yeah. So I was able to get all I got as many warrant databases as I could from all the states. This was a massive FOIA project. Got every state in D.C. and whatnot, got all the warrant databases, got all the prison databases, right? And I matched up who was an active wanted fugitive who was now in prison. And then I found those people, and then I picked some people and worked them in the middle to say, okay, were they stopped by police and let go in the middle? Because then, in theory, they would have stopped the crime that later happened that they went to prison for.
Right.
So I'll kind of give you an example. There was there's two cases that really stick with me. There's a guy named Eloy Williams. I still remember his name. Unique name, right? This was a guy who was wanted for rape out of Florida and a felony drug charge out of Florida. Well, they didn't put the warrants in the system. Right, so this Eloy goes up to Georgia, just one state away, right? He's prowling this suburban Atlanta apartment complex, and the cop there, you know, they see this guy prowling, and they stop him, and they're like, hey, you know, what are you doing here?
Right.
And Eloy gives him a fake name, because Eloy's thinking, you know, the minute I give this guy my real name, I'm done, man. I'm getting hauled to Florida.
Right.
Because I talked to Eloy later, and he told me this, right? So he's freaking out, and he gives the cop fake names. And the cops are smart. They're like, oh, what's your name? Oh, what's your date of birth? What's your social? Well, there's nobody with that name or social, so you're lying to me. Try again. So Eloy does this a couple times. And eventually, he gives him his real name, and Eloy's thinking to himself, I'm done. They're going to haul me back to Florida. This is it. Game's up. And the cop's like, you're going to jail for one day for lying to the police. After that, you're on your way.
Oh.
So Eloy gets out, and he ends up sexually assaulting five more women and a teenage girl.
Oh,
and then Georgia
God.
Picks him up on those rapes. And then eventually Florida gets around and says, hey, there's that warrant we forgot about.
Yeah. Right.
And then there was another case, ironically, out of Florida, kind of the Florida guy angle of everything.
Sure, you know? Yeah.
This was a guy who was wanted for robbery, if I remember correctly, out of Florida. And Florida did put the warrant in the system, but they said, you know, we're only going to go as far as Kentucky. We're going to go in the southeast U.S. to pick this guy up. So what this kid does, he doesn't know that, because none of these guys know that, right?
Right, right.
So, or some do, but a lot of them don't, I should say. So he goes up to Cleveland, suburban Cleveland. He gets arrested outside of a strip club doing goofiness. And the cops there run him, and they're like, aha, this guy's wanted out of Florida. And they call Florida, and they're like, it's just a state too far. Sorry.
No.
We're not going to come pick him up. So in suburban Cleveland, they release this kid. This kid later calls his mom. I talk to his mom. And this kid's like, I think they're setting me up. I don't know why they're releasing me. I'm running out of Florida. So this kid's on edge. This kid's armed. They didn't know he had a gun. He was armed. They didn't know when he had stashed it or something. You know.
Mm-hmm.
Next day, he's in a different city. He's in the city of Cleveland, apparently dealing drugs to make a living. Cleveland police go to stop him. This kid goes to run, and right away, runs up the staircase, turns around and starts shooting, takes out a detective, kills a detective. The other officer shoots in time, kills this kid. But here was a guy who could have been stopped, right?
Right.
Here was a guy who was in police custody 24 hours earlier, wanted fugitive, and they just wouldn't go pick him up. And that story sticks with me because, you know, there wasn't a lot of change. It's such a decentralized system. You know, even in Chicago, we have a system of investigative alerts where the police think they know somebody, but they may not go the extra step for whatever reason, good or bad, to go get the warrant. So I may be wanted on an investigative alert for sexual assault here, but they're never going to know it anywhere else. I drive to Indiana, I drive to Michigan, they're going to stop me and let me go, most likely, because the FBI won't let those in the system because they don't want anybody getting sued for a false arrest, right? Because it's not backed by a judge. So there's this patchwork system in America of how we do this. And unless you're like super wanted, unless the marshals are hunting you down, which are the worst of the worst, they do a good job of hunting down. But if you're in this middle ground of violent, but not violent enough.
Right.
You know,
there's got to be this nationwide database, I'm sure it's frustrating for the police too, because they're trying to go after different people, and if they're not in the system, Carrie, we need you to do a story on this and change the state laws in Illinois when it comes to police.
I'm all for it, and I'm fascinated. You guys have been following, I'm sure, this Timothy Pitson case, and it's like I have so many questions every time I read these stories, right? It's like, how did this 23-year-old pretend he was a 14-year-old, and how did, you know, what happened with the mom, and like there's so many unanswered questions.
There's so many answer questions, and I think when this popped up and I heard about this, and I remembered, I'm sure you both did, too. We were both, you know, you were probably at the Herald or the
AP.
At the Trib, and I was at WGN in a different building, of course, but oh my gosh, when this came up, I thought, I can't believe they found this kid. I remember when the mom left him.
Right.
And, you know, props to the Aurora Police Department for immediately, you know, pouncing on this. And I guess that's a great example of great interstate communication between the police, where they said, hey, we found this. Aurora detectives were out there that day, you know, driving over, and then they knew immediately, this is not the guy.
But I'll tell you, you know, when I was working in St. Louis, there was another case, and the names escape me right now, but there was a kid who was missing for, I want to say, 14 to 15 years.
And they found him?
Yeah. So what happened is there was a second kid abducted. They didn't know the cases were connected, and they had thought, you know, a lot of people thought the first kid was long dead. So a second kid was abducted off of a bike, like 8 or 9 years old, if I'm remembering correctly. And they figure out, they were just able barely to piece this together. It was a white pickup truck another kid had seen, and they kind of figured it out. Like, you got a partial plate, and the police ran all the plates of these numbers, and they just kind of narrowed it down to maybe 20 or 30 people. I remember, and they figured out it was this one guy. Went to his apartment, and then who did they find? This other kid.
Another missing kid?
Yeah, so they found both missing kids.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, so it does happen.
It's like,
does
makes happen. Your skin
it's
crawl.
Scary. Yeah, it does. So,
but then you get to say cases like this other one where this guy's making it up. And it's just.
But there was a startling statistic, I think, in the Tribune story last week that of kids that are missing for 10 or more years, 24% are found. I mean, I felt like that was a pretty good ratio.
I thought that, too.
Like you said, they're long dead.
Yeah. So there is hope out there. We're talking to Carrie Lester and Joe Maher on Andrea and the Report. And when we come back, we are going to find out stories that they are still pursuing and still chasing and tracking down after this on 720 WGN.
Back to Andrea Darlish and the reporters on WGN Radio.
720 WGN, 751, a few more minutes with Joe Maher and Carrie Lester, and then Lori Lightfoot's going to join us after the 8 o'clock news, talk about a big day, I believe, for her camp with regard to Lincoln Yards, that vote being put off. We're talking to Carrie and Joe a little bit, and you guys both have mentioned two things that I want to focus on before I ask you what you're chasing and stories, projects that are still out there for you. But you both have said anonymous sources and off the record. And I think in these times, I think in many capacities, the media is under attack as far as false news or fake news and different things like that. But I think the majority of people see that, you know, when Associated Press cites anonymous sources, and you said, Carrie, this is at the highest level of being discreet and the highest level of trust. You know, we're not going to put something out there if it's off the record. So I think it's just important to touch on that fact that while journalism is under attack, there are reporters like both of you and most reporters out there who really respect what that means.
Right. And sometimes it kills you in a small way that there are a lot of stories that you feel like are great stories that you just can't tell right now. And
right.
You hope you'll be able to at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I've always told people, you know, listen, you know, if you need to talk to me off the record, I understand. Right.
Right. Off the record.
You know, you got a job, you've got family. I just need to know that you're being honest with me.
Right.
You know, you just point me in the right direction. Right. And I've many of my sources over the years have been probably like yours too, have been off the record, and you honor that because there's reasons. Now, sometimes we get misled too. Right. You know,
right. And you got to separate your camps. Right. Sometimes you have the off the record source guiding you in the right direction, and then you need to fill in your quotes with the on the record source. And it's this puzzle piece to your daily coverage.
You have to be respectful. And all right, Carrie and I want to know where you keep the Pulitzer.
Yes.
It's in a cabinet in my dining room, and it is yet to be broken.
Okay. Do you polish it a lot?
No.
Do you ever just hold it?
I don't sit out there and polish it like I'm some like 70s like gangster boss.
I feel like, what is the story? The Sandlot where they steal it? Did your kids ever steal it? Did it ever go missing? Did it?
You know, no. Surprisingly, you would think it would.
Right?
You know, it makes a really cool prism. If you put it in the light, it like shines a light a certain way. So it's that's the coolest thing.
See, that's
the light of truth.
They would play with it and like, oh, it's really cool.
Don't touch Daddy's toy. Don't touch Daddy's award.
That's right.
Carrie, I have to ask you, you're the author of Know My Place, the state's first in-depth look at the sexual harassment experiences of women working in Illinois government and politics. We had you on the Cochran Show when the book first came out, and you brought to the attention that it was Kim Fox and Lisa Madigan.
And Lisa Madigan and Anna Valencia, and just my thought in writing it was not that sadly every
eye-opening.
Woman has a story, right, of some degree, and so I wanted to show that it runs the gamut in Illinois government and politics. So.
Are you going to write another book?
I'm working working on one. I'm working on one on now retired former House Majority Leader Barbara Flynn Curry, who was a Madigan deputy for a long time, and kind of Illinois' Ruth Bader Ginsburg in a way, this tiny little dynamo and respected across the aisle. And I felt in some ways that she was dealt with, holding the bag for a lot of the stuff that was going on last year. And so she didn't really take much of a victory lap. And so sitting down with her over the last 6 months and hearing her story of how she was married to a constitutional law professor from the University of Chicago and how she got involved in politics and how she towed this line between Hyde Park Progressive and Madigan Confidant, it's been really, really interesting, as have been, you know, the retro photos. And, you know, she used to smoke about three packs a day. Yeah. And just all these cool stories.
My favorite smoking story was Judy Bartopinka when she was controller and she was in the office at the Thompson Center and she'd have press conferences and hold the cigarette behind her back like we couldn't see the smoke billowing for, you know, beyond her head. And we're like, Judy, isn't this a smoke-free building? And she'd be like, yes. What's your point? Do you have a question or not? Yes, ma'am.
She was quite a character.
I miss her, you know, too. Yeah. Straight talking. Great. She was awesome.
Yeah, loved her. Was. All right, so what's next for both of you?
You know, for me, I can't really talk about some of the stuff, you know.
Right.
So, but, you know, it's really just trying to dig into a lot of it government, you know, looking at data, trying to see where the stories are, working tips. You know, there's just one of the dilemmas with journalism now is that, you know, we have less and less beat reporters in general. So
it's true.
So trying to get the
man
tips.
Man to man to zone.
Exactly. Work the tips. And, you know, trying to do it efficiently and get as much info as we can to the people, you know.
Absolutely. Keep on keeping on. Carrie, how about you? What's next for you?
Oh, gosh. There's the book. I have all these different story ideas. But one, you know, I told you I started as a journalist for a Catholic paper. I'm fascinated by the abuse crisis. My husband teases me like, you know, of course you've read this story. But, you know, between the church consolidating many of its parishes, you know, and its lack of funding and the abuse crisis, I want to connect the dots in a better and clearer way for people. And so it's a pie in the sky idea.
Maybe it'll be an Academy Award winner.
Oh, we'll see.
You know? So. Very good. And where can people find you on social media if they want to follow your stories or follow you online?
Sure. I am on, my Twitter is, that shows how old I am. It's just my name. Joemahr.
Mine too.
Mine too.
It's okay. So there you go.
Mine's not Jomar, but so we're all carrying Lester Jomar on radar. Let's see.
Facebook, I believe, is the same. But I'm more of a Twitter guy.
And we can read you in the Chicago Tribune.
There you go.
And online. Carrie, where can we find you?
Yeah, same. Just, I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram, though. That's mostly kid pictures and food pictures. But at centerforillinoispolitics.com.
You had Lincoln Yards today. I retweeted you.
Yeah.
So thank you for that.
No problem.
Very good.
No
Carrie Jo, thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for having us.
Take a quick break here. We'll have some news. And then Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot joins us at 8:05. 720 WGN.